supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we have a wonderfully jam-packed show for you today, cats and kittens. We have an interview with one of our favorite people, Ken Drews, who has a new book on gardening in the shade with a very different take on why you should be embracing your shade in addition to what you can plant in it. We're also going to answer three questions about trees in the summertime. We better hop right over to your fascinating phone calls so we can take some at 1-888-346-9499. Margie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am doing good, Margie. How are you?
I'm great. I'm out shopping for native plants right now.
Oh, okay. Good. And where are you, or where are you shopping, or, you know, what part of the
shopping
world?
Shopping in Schwanksville, but I live in Collegeville, which is very close by.
Okay. Schwanksville, home of the fabulous Philadelphia Folk Festival every year.
Yes, it is.
All right. What can we do for Margie, who's shopping for native plants?
I had heard your show 2 weeks ago. I think there was a woman who called in about a lithrum plant that she was trying to save. And I knew that that was purple loosestrife, which is, I think, not allowed to be sold anymore. And she was wondering why. And the reason it turned out, and I don't know where I originally got the information, but I've known it for quite some years, the cultivars that they had sold back when they were still allowed to were supposed to be sterile plants that didn't produce any viable seed. But it has turned out that when these are out in the open environment where they can possibly be cross-pollinated with the species or possibly other, quote, sterile cultivars, that the seed they produce does become viable and they become just as invasive as the original plants that have taken over the waterways and wetlands.
Oh, boy, did I catch heck for that phone call. We got some incendiary emails. We got some messages left on our phone that we had to hold the earpiece a little away from our heads so as not to get burned by it. I felt the call was interesting because she was talking about a loosestrife that was technically not invasive, that had been bred to be sterile, not theoretically, the loosestrife that's all around us in the woods. And, you know, I allowed myself to get theoretical. And
I knew you were a little apprehensive about it because you had said nature finds a way.
And it's so funny because you're telling me that I was Jeff Goldblum and I was correct here because I was warning her that even though she was talking about this theoretically sterile plant, that famous line, nature will find a way. And I tell you, I didn't even need to wait for your phone call to reassure me. The dinosaurs started chasing me as soon as that phone call was over on the show. There is something about purple loosestrife that brings out the high side of people, let's say.
Well, if you've ever been up through New England, especially in the fall, in the late summer and fall, it just blankets the countryside. It just takes over everything, and it's so hard to get rid of.
I did warn her about purple loosestrife, you know, but she kept trying to convince me it was something kind of different, and so I reluctantly told her, you know, without really any knowledge, what theoretically how you would propagate such a plant. And boy, did I catch heck for that.
Yeah, well, hopefully she hasn't done it, and hopefully she hasn't shared it with anyone that, on the reassurance to them that it's not productive, that it won't make seed.
Well, the reassuring thing seems to be that she couldn't keep these things alive to begin with.
That was helpful, yes. And now, they have in Canada, they've introduced a beetle that feeds on it. Of course, there's always a problem with those methods, too. But at least they are getting some control over it with this beetle. But I don't think we're doing that here in the U.S. So.
Thank you for calling, because now I can make my apologies. I can say my perfect act of horticultural contrition here. and warn people that this may pop up again, that somebody may propose a variety of a plant that's not invasive or that is sterile or something like that.
Yeah.
But if this is one of the plants that's out of control, you really either do 100 hours of research before you even consider it, or just take a pass and plant something different.
Don't trust it. There's so many wonderful native plants to put in that take care of pollinators and caterpillars and all the things that we need. So, loosestrife, goodbye and good riddance.
I have to admit, I love the flowers.
They are beautiful. But there are a lot of beautiful, dangerous things out there, and that's certainly one of them.
Exactly. All right, Marg. Well,
thank you for taking my call, and I hope the information gets out there and gets all these folks off your trail.
Well, thank you for making it and helping us understand what plant she was talking about and the history behind it.
Okay.
All right.
Enjoy your show. I'd never miss it, and I will be listening for you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Take care.
Thanks, Mike. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Bill, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, thank you.
Well, thank you, Bill. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. And yourself?
I am just ducky today. And where is Bill doing well?
I'm doing well in Clinton, New Jersey, right along the south branch of the Raritan River.
Right along I-78, named for our former president.
Exactly.
All right, Bill, what can we do for Bill Clinton? Oh, welcome to the show, Bill.
Well, my last name's not Clinton, but I do live in Clinton. I've been a flatland traditional gardener for some time, you know, the plowing, the soil harrowing, the whole bit.
Right.
But, you know, every year the weeds seem to be either getting younger or more numerous, or I'm getting older, but it's just been quite a struggle for me to keep up with them. So I bit the bullet and decided to abandon that and go to raised beds.
Excellent.
So I actually have some very good soil on my property, but I'm reading that it needs to be lightened for raised beds. And so I'm wondering what is a cost-effective way to fill the raised beds with such things as vermiculite and chemical-free type soil. So I was wondering if you had any cost-effective alternatives or what you suggest.
Okay, so the essence of raised beds is you're going to till up one more time. That's going to bring a lot of weed seeds to the surface, but I'll tell you how to get rid of them. You're going to construct areas that are no wider than 4 feet, but they can be as long as you want. Most people like to build beds that are 4 by 8 feet because it uses standard sizes of lumber. It's very easy to walk around, and you want to have 2-foot walking lanes in between the raised beds. Now, when I built my first raised bed garden, I had a big load of mushroom soil compost delivered, tilled it all up, built the raised beds, and then I found out just by hoeing and shoveling the soil out of the lanes, I was pretty much able to fill the raised beds. And back then, I really didn't need to lighten it up. However, I think you're smart to start with the idea of lightening up your soil. It would be good if you could get a load of municipal compost dumped off at your place and mix that in with your garden soil. But otherwise, to keep it light in the future, I use exclusively perlite.
Oh, perlite, okay.
Yeah, not vermiculite. There have been some issues with asbestos contamination of vermiculite in the past, and I just find perlite to be superior in lightening up the soil, and they tend to cost the same. And I'll tell you, if you're doing this on a large scale, you want to go to a farm supply store. Small-scale organic farmers buy the bags or the size of like 100-pound potato bags.
Right.
You know, but they weigh almost nothing, which is so much fun because this popped rock material is just so lightweight. And I would mix that in with your soil. You got a lot of wiggle room here. Just the fact that you're adding some perlite is a good thing. You will never regret that you added a lot, especially when we get real rainy times. It's keeps the air around the roots of plants. It's the only outside input I really use in my garden these days, as I continue to lighten up my raised beds with perlite just about every fall. So when you get your raised beds built,
Yes.
And you get everything leveled off. Now you've tilled up the soil. You've really mixed it up. Now the weeds are going to come up. So you get a very sharp hoe. And about 2 weeks after you have finished your raised beds and water them in between if times are dry, get a very sharp hoe and very gently slice off any plants that grow up out of your raised beds right at the soil line. And that's it. That's 90%, 95% of the weeds that would have shown up in those raised beds. That's called a stale seed bed. And because they're only 4 foot wide, you're not going to step in them. So there's never going to be a reason to plow them up again. You're going to have to find a new hobby in the spring. No more plowing, no more tilling, no more losing soil nutrients, destroying the structure, bringing weed seeds to the surface. You'll just add an inch or two of fresh compost to the top of the beds every year, maybe mixed in with more perlite. And where do you see the results you get with raised beds? You'll never go back.
Yeah, well, that's encouraging. Well, thank you so much, Mike. You gave me good advice and encouragement going forward. So.
And good luck to Hillary in the election.
There you go. Take care, Mike.
All right, Bill. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I am coming to Dayton to do a special WYSO member event Friday evening, October 2nd, and a big public event on Saturday, October 3rd. But don't go offering me a ride back to the airport just yet. Because we'll be right back with Ken Drews explaining why you should embrace shade, how to prune trees with three different problems, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by Burpee, celebrating their 139th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, fruits of all kinds, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, when's the best time to trim a magnolia? If a tree has dead branches, should they be removed right away or should you wait? And can you help fruit trees that have become overgrown even after a hard pruning? We're going to answer all three of those questions at the end of the show. We're also going to take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time to welcome back one of our favorite guests, Ken Drews, author of The New Shade Garden, Creating a Lush Oasis in the Age of Climate Change. Ken, always a pleasure to have you. Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, thank you, Mike. It's a pleasure.
So a provocative title, not just The New Shade Garden, but linking shade gardens to climate change. Explain yourself, Mr. Drews.
Easy. Well, in 1992, I wrote a book called The Natural Shade Garden that was an enormous hit. and I've been gardening mostly in shade for my adult life. And I thought I should revisit the topic in a new book. But I've come to see shade as more than a situation we find ourselves in or something we have to deal with. I want people to make shade. For one thing, it's 10 to 20 degrees cooler in the shade, and who wants to be hot? And with the changes in the climate, it's definitely getting warmer, so staying out of the sun appeals to people for their own health and for the health of the planet, because shade gardens are more sustainable, they require less water, they require virtually no fertilizer, they improve the soil, I want people to plant trees. There's many reasons why this is the garden of the future.
In terms of climate change, the old days of the 70s when we all decided we were going to be small-scale farmers and support ourselves 5 acres in independence, we were looking for places with full sun or, God forbid, cutting down the occasional tree to grow better tomatoes.
Well, we have to do that. There are not very many edible plants that grow in a shady situation.
So you take the position that as our planet warms, we're going to want cooler places to hide out in. And without getting overly dramatic about it, it would be really nice to have a cool spot to hide in the summertime should something happen to the grid. And it's all we got.
Yes, and recently I read that the American Cancer Association recommended that people stay out of the sun between 10 and 4 p.m., which doesn't work with the swimming pool or the beach, and I don't really like to sit in the sun in the beach. I'd much rather go to a place that's 20 degrees cooler, and that's what I do. And if you've got trees, you can go to the shady place, or maybe you have to plant trees or make a pergola or have an awning, someplace to get out of the sun for your own health and just to be cooler. Who doesn't want to be cooler?
I was at a place, historic Smithville. It's a great mansion, an old estate in New Jersey. But one thing I'd remembered from previous years is the estate still had their old existing grape arbor that probably had to go back 100 years because, you know, these grapevines, as they get into their 60s, 70s, and 80s, they take on such musculature. They have such character down low. But I can remember the first time I walked into this arbor, I looked around because I thought it was one of those misting systems that, you know, sprays cool water to give you a break while you're outside. And it was God's misting system or the Romans' misting system because all it was this grape arbor that had this perfect combination of big leaves to block the sun, but lots of open spaces for breezes to get through. I didn't want to leave. I wanted to hold my lecture in the grape arbor. You know,
you should have.
Yeah.
Well, that kind of shade is terrific. And even beyond that, I think that the shade from trees is very important, and we talked about that for a second about planting trees. But when I talk to people and when I think about trees and I ask them what do they think trees are made out of, they sometimes say, well, it's water and nutrients. But really, the tree is made out of carbon. The tree is growing, and as it produces leaves and it produces branches and trunks, that's all made out of carbon that the trees are taking out of the atmosphere and sequestering. They're holding that carbon. So that's another kind of anti-global warming thing that we can do just by planting trees.
Right. That's the old first thing you learn in first grade is that plants take in our carbon dioxide and they give us some oxygen.
Perfect. What could be better?
Yeah.
And trees also fight erosion. When there's rain, and I see so many people cutting down trees and putting in lawn, and then it rains and the fertilizer from the lawn goes into the water and the streams, and it's just such a mess. But trees break the force of the rain. And in my area, we have a different kind of rain now. We used to have sort of a rainy day. Now we have these thunderstorms that produce a whole lot of rain in a short amount of time, and actually not that much rain in a short amount of time, do a lot of damage. But the tree leaves really break the force of the rain and fight erosion. There's just so many reasons to go back to the way things were, in a way.
Now, when we talk about the traditional shade garden, a lot of people are blessed with extensive shade on lots of our properties. And I think you and I have been both surprised by the number of plants that will flower in shade. I mean, we've always known about the unholy trinity, the coward's shade garden, hostas, impatiens, and begonias. But it goes much further than that in terms of flowering color and shade.
Especially with hostas. And I remember in 1992 when that first book came out, people didn't know about hostas, and it wasn't so popular. Now hostas are the most popular herbaceous perennial. So I think we have to look at foliage and the interest in foliage, because we're not going to have as many flowers and as much color from flowers in a shady place. But you mentioned hostas, for example, fantastic all season long interest. We've got all the plants in the spring that are going to bloom, not necessarily for cutting.
Well, I always remind people, or when the subject comes up correctly, I remind people that the Native American rhododendron is beyond an understory plant. I mean, it's almost like the world's biggest ground cover underneath the shadow of this deciduous hardwood forest.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because people think ground covers have to be, you know, 3 inches tall. But anything that spreads, even in the understory, and covers the ground is a ground cover. And all those plants are helping to keep moisture in the soil, helping to recharge the soil. More powers for the shade garden.
And again, we're always dropping back to the spring, which is the easiest time, because in the spring, the shade garden is more of a sunny garden and we've got more opportunity. It's really as the summer progresses that the shade garden truly becomes shady in most situations. And one thing you mention in your book that I really hadn't thought about, even though it's at my house and it's a living example, is how well hydrangeas do with limited light.
And I'm like head over heels for hydrangea arborescens. They're so easy to grow. There's Annabelle is probably the most popular one. There's one called Hydrangea arborescens radiata that has platinum colored undersides to the leaves.
It just sounds insane.
They're so easy to grow. And I can't grow the big mop head types because my season's too short. That's why you sometimes see those by the seashore, because the water moderates the temperatures. And of course, in the Philadelphia area, they do very well.
So hydrangeas are one that people don't expect. You've got daylilies in here.
Well, you know, those roadside daylilies, which that's kind of a thug in a way, because they're not like the regular daylilies. They're rhizotomous. They sort of creep underground. But those will do in partial shade. I find that some of the modern hybrids really don't make it too well in the shade, but the old types and the species all do well, and they're blooming pretty much in summer.
And a local weed I call fleabane, the little daisy flowers, that just shows up all throughout my garden, and the pollinators and the beneficial insects love it, and it's pretty.
Encouraging beneficial insects is certainly something we all want to do. And we have to deal with a lot of not beneficial insects these days. We have a lot of invasive alien plants and we have invasive alien critters. And with climate change, we're finding that there's new problems. And with warmer temperatures and with more carbon in the air, things like poison ivy are doing really well. They love to absorb the carbon out of the air.
Every vine is doing well. Wild grape, wild wisteria, Virginia creeper, which is a native, but that doesn't mean it's not invasive. I've got many vines. And as I go through the woods foraging for berries and stuff, I realize one of the biggest enemies of my future harvests is these vines. They are just schoolyard bullies. They're not, they make ivy look well behaved, Ken.
That's true. Well, this year, 2015, we've had the perfect year for vines. We had a little dry before they came out, and now we've had about rain once a week. And in the Philadelphia area, you usually have like 44 inches of rain a year. This year, we're having more than that. Everything's bigger. I just hope it doesn't stop. You know how some summers we have a lot of rain, then August it stops and everything turns brown and we don't have any fall color.
Yeah. You have a lot of distinctions in your book. Light shade, filtered shade, medium shade. Would you agree that one of the biggest distinctions, however, and one of the hardest ones for gardeners to wrap their heads around, is the difference between dry shade and wet shade?
Ooh. Dry shade, that's the bane of the shade garden.
But if you've got a lot of trees and a normal water level, you got dry shade, honey.
And there are plants that can tolerate dry shade, like Epimedium, which is a wonderful ground cover that blooms in the spring. And, you know, I mentioned before about putting pots under trees. I think that's one of the best ways to deal with root competition.
Do people not think about containers in an area where they would normally plant in the ground enough? I know as I've gotten older, containers are us.
You don't have to bend over quite so much.
And again, if you have trees in dry shade, the trees are doing well. They have vigorous roots. The plants you try to install are going to be unhappy and the trees are going to be unhappy.
People just don't seem to make that connection.
Then again, wet shade, especially really wet shade, is no bargain.
Well, that's true. And a lot of the plants that like to be in a really wet situation want to have a lot of sun too. Those plants usually have big leaves. It's one way that you can tell the shade plants too, is they either have a lot of small leaves that cover a lot of area like a fern, or they have the big wide leaves like a hosta. So when you go shopping, you can often tell the plants that might tolerate or even love shade, because you can't always go by the tags on the plants.
Right. I used to love to grow canna lilies. And one thing I discovered is if you give a canna lily a lot of sun, it'll produce enormous tropical flowers at the top. If you give a canna lily deep shade, it'll produce the most remarkable leaf structure.
Ooh.
So, I mean, just because a plant is supposed to flower, you don't necessarily need that if it's going to give you a dramatic kind of leaf painting.
And sometimes the flowers on those plants only last a couple of days, whereas the leaves are all season long.
Well, I mean, and it's a great diversity. And you've got a great diversity of plants here in the book. You make a case for establishing more shade, which is like, instead of just trying to deal with climate change politically, I guess you're telling people, do it locally. Make your little spot a little cooler and maybe it'll spread.
Yeah, it's really looking at nature and learning from the way nature gardens and helping our gardens be more natural and sustainable and earth-friendly.
All right. Ken Drews is the author of The New Shade Garden, Creating a Lush Oasis in the Age of Climate Change. It is brand new from Stuart Tabori and Chang. And Ken, it's always a pleasure to have you.
Oh, Mike, thanks so much.
You're always welcome on You Bet Your Garden. And now, back to your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Sean, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Sean. How are you, sir?
Real good.
And where is Sean good?
I'm up in Johnsonburg, Pennsylvania, Elk County, Northwestern PA.
Northwestern PA, okay.
Yep.
What can we do for you?
I've got zucchinis and cucumbers in my garden. The leaves are all turning gray on them. I compost and added mushroom mulch this spring. I seem to have that problem every year, though.
Okay, Sean, are you growing in flat earth or raised beds?
Raised bed.
Oh, okay, good, good, good. And you say they're filled with compost and mushroom soil?
Yes, sir.
Are the cucumbers supported? Are they growing up a trellis?
Nope, they're on the ground.
Okay, so that's what you need to do with the cucumbers. Cucumbers are vining plants, and I'm presuming you've had a lot of the heavy rains that have hit our portion of Pennsylvania. Raised beds do drain better, but plants that are laying on the ground that typically in nature are supported are going to get all moldy when they're laying on wet ground and they stay wet. As you can imagine, the undersides of the leaves don't get to dry out. So rig up something as simple as an old-style tomato cage, a piece of fencing. They make different trellises for this. Remember, anytime a plant is called a vine, that means it should get support. You get your cucumbers up off the ground, and I think that'll get rid of the powdery mildew on them. Now, are your zucchini vining zucchini or bush-style zucchini? And are the plants really crowded?
Yes.
So that's the problem there. Oddly enough, I know it seems counterintuitive, but you will get more fruit and better fruit from four plants in a raised bed that have a lot of room in between them than eight or nine plants all jammed close together. Again, especially when we have the kind of rainy weather and kind of extended cool periods we have, you want there to be a lot of airflow between the plants, and you want the plants that are natural climbers, you know, like cucumbers and tomatoes, to be well supported and staying up off the ground. It's really just simple physics. The more air you get around the plants, especially underneath the leaves, the better you're going to do in a wet season. Sometimes you can get away with a little bit of crowding and laying around in a hot and dry season, but when it's rainy for a couple of days, that's really just death to plants. And I know it seems hard to do, but it's the same thing we have to do when we start our own tomatoes. You have to thin the plants. So really, the answer here is to go in, take a good look at your zucchini, your bush zucchini plants, pull off all the leaves that look really bad and throw those in the trash. Then take a look at the plants themselves and maybe lose one or two of them to create more room and more airflow. That and get the cucumbers off the ground, and I think you're up and running. I think you're off to the circus after that.
That sounds great, Mike. Thank you very much.
All right. Good luck, Sean.
Thank you.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll appear on Saturday, September 5th at the Lee Highway Nursery in Warrenton, Virginia. On Friday evening, September 11th at the Spring City Library in Chester County. And at the Horsham Township Library on Wednesday evening, September 16th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with how to prune trees with three different problems and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, makers of Biotone Starter Plus for new transplants, full of beneficial microbes and mycorrhiza for deeper roots and stronger plants. Espoma, a natural in the garden since 1929.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, a trio of troubles about trees. When should you prune a magnolia? What do you do with the dead wood in a tree? When is it safe to cut it out? And what do you do if you pruned your fruit trees and they're overgrown again? We'll answer all three of those questions after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Lillian, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Yeah, hello.
Hello, Lillian. How are you?
I'm fine.
And where is Lillian fine?
State College, Pennsylvania.
In Happy Valley. Does that mean you're
yeah.
happy
yeah.
out there?
Yeah.
What can we do for Lillian in State College?
Well, I have some rhubarb plants, and they've been here. I've lived in this house for 51 years, so those rhubarb plants are about 50 years old. And they grow fine, and they produce nice thick stalks, but there are a lot of tiny spindly sticks. And I wondered if I should fertilize them periodically, or they're in the shade.
Oh, really?
And sun sometimes.
Okay.
And maybe I should transplant them.
Well, that's part of the answer. One of the interesting things. Now, I do not personally grow rhubarb. And, you know, it is the only vegetable that we eat as a fruit. It is very unique. It's kind of on its own in the plant world. But when I did my big coffee table book for Abrams, the art book publishers, called Kitchen Garden A to Z, obviously we needed to come up with something for each letter. And I wound up researching and writing about rhubarb, which we also did when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine. And when you told me your plants were decades old, I immediately knew what was wrong. And I think the solution is very simple, although that plant could be pretty honking big, and you might want to get help doing this. Every 5 years or so, a rhubarb plant will become so internally crowded that the production drops off. So what rhubarb craves most of all is to be dug up every 5 years or so and split into multiple plants. Now, again, this could be a big chore. You could have a rhubarb root the size of Manhattan down there at this point. So you're going to get, you know, get some of those big college boys from like the football team with shovels. And in the spring, ideally, or even in the late fall after all the greenery has died back, I would dig up the entire root. And then this thing is going to be honking big, Lil. I mean, this is going to be a big root. So with a smaller plant, we would divide it, maybe by pulling it apart with garden forks. This may need a chainsaw or something like that. And cut it up into at least four different sections, and then replant those sections in nice loose ground that sits up high. You can put some in more sun. You can put some in more shade. You can put one of them right back to where it was growing. And then in the spring, when the new growth appears, I would give it a nice feeding of some compost, some worm castings. I wouldn't feed it chemical fertilizers. With rhubarb, you could even use well-composted horse manure because it's just a nitrogen-loving plant. I know it does kind of flower at one point, but that doesn't count. You're growing the stalks. This is a plant like asparagus that does well with well-composted horse manure. That means there's no smell, no heat to it, because fresh horse manure is very weedy. But the important thing is they do need to be divided about every 5 years to really produce those big red stalks that you're looking for.
Yeah.
You're going to have tons of rhubarb. People will be coming by to, you know, take it off your hands and make good rhubarb pie.
Yeah. I have one friend that comes and makes rhubarb muffins and pies and all that good stuff.
So that's the answer, though, Lil, is divide it, break it up into smaller plants, replant it, give it some food, and all of your stalks are going to be big and red.
Yeah. So, okay, it was nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you, Lil. You take good care of your rhubarb, and I hope you have a big harvest this spring.
Okay, thank you.
Take care.
Send you a piece of pie.
All right, now you're talking.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. John, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how you doing?
I am doing just fine today, John. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you.
And where is John well?
In Germantown, Pennsylvania.
Oh, very good. A fabulous, ancient neighborhood of Philadelphia.
Yes, it is.
All right, what can I do for John in Germantown?
I have a raised bed garden. It's very large. About 15 feet by 15 feet. I have it surrounded with corrugated plastic and chicken wire, and I can look right at out of my bedroom over my garden. I have tomatoes, big boy tomatoes, carrots, and a whole bed of cucumbers. Just as the cucumbers started to sprout, I went out and looked. I had like five little cucumbers. Next day I went out, I didn't have five little cucumbers. So I just sat in my bedroom window early in the morning, and there was a little fat gray field mouse going in and out of my cucumbers. I tried traps. I got one mouse, and it's been happening now for like 4 days. And I have a neighbor that's across the street has 12 beehives. So I'm getting really good pollination, lots of bees. But as fast as the cucumbers come up, a little fat mouse eats them. I want to know what I can do.
Well, mice can do incredible feats. I once thought I'd caught a mouse in my basement, and then I watched it run straight up the side of a blank wall and lose itself in the ceiling work. I was both terrified, horrified, and amazed. And I know from my work with the Common Sense Pest Control people that they can squeeze through really tight little openings. So chicken wire will stop rabbits, but it won't stop mice. Now,
yeah, I mostly have the chicken wire for the larger things.
Right. One thing you can do around the base of your garden is you can go buy a material called hardware cloth. This is almost like window screening, but made of much heavier metal.
Right.
And it wouldn't have to be very high, and you would cut it to fit your garden, and you would sink it an inch or two in the ground, and then you would have it come up a couple of inches, and then you would bend the top section out as a baffle. Because, like I said, they're very good climbers. So the material at ground level won't stop them. They'll climb up. But if you bend the last couple inches out as a baffle, they'll just keep getting dropped back down on their furry little butts.
Right. They have to go upside down.
Right, exactly. It's very similar to the fencing designed to keep out groundhogs on a much larger level. You need that baffle for climbing creatures. But you know there's also a new kind of mousetrap out there. And this is something that I've been thinking of getting for myself because we have mice who try to come into the house every winter, and I use conventional snap traps to kind of capture them. And I don't like the idea, well, I don't use mouse traps outside because I'd be afraid of catching a bird. They'd be attracted to the peanut butter as well.
Well, all I caught was ants.
With a trap? What kind of trap?
Yeah, with peanut butter, snap trap.
Oh, okay. So what you can do, and this is nice because it's a one-time investment. And let's be honest, you know, the homes in Germantown are 90% old. They've got mice tunnels in the house. Mice come in the winter.
Yes.
This would be a purchase that could serve you well. They are called, I'm confusing them with something else. Zap Trapper, my producer is saying, because I got her to get them, right?
Right.
And these are like little boxes powered by AA batteries, and they have a green light on the outside. And they have the mouse holes that are irresistible to mice. The mice go in, they get an electrical shock or killed, the light turns red, so then you just turn it upside down, you flick it out into a trash can, and you reset it, and you put it back down. They are said to be incredibly successful. And the field mice you're describing are the prime carriers of the ticks that spread Lyme disease. The so-called deer tick is more often found on a mouse than on a deer.
Right.
So I would use caution, but that's what I would do in your situation because the fencing would have to be absolutely perfect. They are good climbers. I would just get one or two of these traps, put them in the garden, empty them out, and, you know, maybe because mice are so persistent, maybe you do both. Maybe you get the hardware cloth and one or two of these traps. But between the two of those, you should be able to do it. Your other option would be to get the hardware cloth and make sure the holes are big enough for bees but too small for mice. They come in all different shapes and sizes. And literally wrap your cucumbers in hardware cloth with room for the bees to get in, but to exclude the mice.
Okay.
All right, but one or both of those is going to be your answer, John.
All right, well, thank you so much.
Take care.
All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Pruning trees in the summertime. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, get us started by reading the first of this week's trio of tree questions.
I'd be happy to. Marcus in Clarksville, Tennessee writes, "When is the best time to trim a magnolia tree? I have one whose branches are drooping down to the ground and the tree's profile is uneven. Can it be trimmed without hurting it?"
Well, it really pays to know your species here. There are a number of different types of magnolia. Some are evergreen, some are deciduous, and their bloom times can vary quite a bit. The general advice is to prune the deciduous types, you know, the ones that drop their leaves in winter, right after their flowers fade in the spring. And to prune evergreen types, like the hugely popular grandiflora, the native southern magnolia, before new growth begins in the spring.
But I think I hear a big but in your voice.
Really? Does this question make my voice look big? Okay. But every source also warns that you shouldn't prune them unless you absolutely have to, especially older trees. Our pruning guru, Lee Reich, warns that magnolias heal very slowly after pruning and that you should always try and shape them while they're still young. The Southern Living Garden book echoes those warnings, especially with the deciduous types, but they also leave the door open for some pruning to correct shape and remove those very low branches.
So what's your advice?
Figure out exactly what kind of magnolia you have. Do the absolute least to it you can live with. Do that at the best possible time of year for that species, and then see how the tree responds before you do it again. Because if you just go whacking away at these plants when you feel like it, you could end up minus a magnolia.
Well, we also heard from Bruce in Gaithersburg, who writes, "I've had my American hornbeam for about 4 or 5 years, and it was doing great until this year, when a lot of the top branches didn't green up. Should I leave it alone or prune out the dead branches?"
Well, Bruce sent us a picture of his hornbeam, an excellent and underutilized landscape tree that shows good growth down low, but dead branches sticking out of the top. The basic answer here is easy. You should always remove dead, diseased, or severely damaged branches as soon as you see them. Seasonal pruning rules do not apply to dead wood. So when you do this, remove the entire affected branch in sections if the branch is long and heavy, going all the way back to the tree, but leaving the branch collar, that round donut-shaped section where the branch meets the trunk, attached to the tree. Don't cut flush to the trunk, and don't seal the pruning cuts with anything. These trees don't need it.
I hear another butt coming.
Well, it's better than seeing it coming. Anyway, yes. I was suspicious, and so I asked Bruce to send us a picture of the base of the tree.
Oh no, not another case of volcano mulching.
Chips the color of a Burger King mounded up against the bottom 6 inches of the trunk of this poor tree. I told Bruce to scrape it all away, expose the root flare of the tree, and just hope that the bark hasn't been rotted or eaten away in a complete circle.
Oh, well, yeah, then there's no hope.
Nah, and that'd be a real shame. These hornbeams are great trees.
We finish up with Dave, just outside of Dover, Delaware. He writes, "I have 14 assorted fruit trees, which you and your friend Lee Reich have educated me to prune during dormancy, which I do every year. However, my plum, apple, and apricot trees have since grown significantly, and I'm seeing disease that I feel certain is being caused by the density of the biomass and resulting bad airflow. What should I do if I vigorously prune in the winter but still have dramatic growth in the spring and summer? I know that pruning at the end of summer or in the fall can do a lot of harm, but can I prune in early to midsummer to open things up?
We should add here that Dave's email went on in length and that his trees are mulched with compost, his lawn is organic, there's plenty of room between his trees, and he sprays them with Surround, the same clay spray I use to protect my peaches, so he has really tried to prevent these kinds of problems.
So no buts here. He's doing all the basic things correctly. Then what's the answer?
Prune and prune again.
Nah, really?
Yep. And I wouldn't know this if I hadn't planted my own peach trees years ago. I wait until mine are flowering, and then I prune them. And when I do, I really open them up to try to get great internal airflow. The week after that, I worry I pruned them too much. By the next week, I'm not worried anymore. And then some years, the new growth is so lush, I have to prune them again. I probably wind up double pruning every second or third year.
I'm really surprised to hear you say this.
I was surprised when the first time I had to do it, but airflow really is everything with fruit trees. Yikes, my producer is threatening to prune me with prejudice if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or if you're willing to include your location, you can send us an email. Send us your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore with your location at garden@whyy.org. Oh, and please include your location. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where we don't care about your location, but where you will find all the answers to all those questions you were going to ask us, as well as audio of this show, past shows, and our popular podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz keeps our website up and running. The perfectly pruned Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our editor, Al Banks, well, he's kind of in need of a little trim. Steven, Dre like the horse, Ho like the tool, and Bull like the animal is upping the ante on the anticipated antics and abilities of incoming interns. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and all I'm saying is I better get good peaches this season. You hear me, trees? Or it's chainsaw time. You got that, trees? Oh, and the rest of you, I'll see you next week.
Timber!
When grass fails to thrive near trees, shade gets all the blame. I'm producer Alexis Landis. Join Mike McGrath on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden when we'll reveal that aqua is often the actual antagonist, plus answers to all your growing questions.